Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and columnist Glenn Greenwald, who discusses his concern that in President Obama's second term, the nation will continue to see the erosion of civil liberties. Jamie Henn of the climate change organization 350.org, who talks about the goals of his group's divestment campaign, which is pressuring colleges and universities to divest their portfolios of fossil fuel stocks. And Frank Hammer, a retired United Auto Workers Union activist, who assesses the latest assault on workers' rights as Michigan state government approves anti-union right-to-work legislation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Obama administration and Pentagon officials are considering asking Congress for authority to pursue Islamic militants in Mali and nearby African countries, including Niger, Nigeria, Chad, and Algeria. Some of these armed militias have loose or non-existent ties to al-Qaeda's top leaders based in Pakistan. According to the Wall Street Journal, congressional authorization could cover the Pentagon deployment of armed drones and counterterror teams across North Africa, an area bigger in size than Iraq and Afghanistan combined. Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb now controls northern Mali. Western intelligence believes the group has set up camps to train militants across the region. Militants took control over northern Mali after a March 2011 coup led to the disintegration of the Mali military, and rebel groups took control over much of the West African nation. The United Nations Security Council is now debating a plan to send a 3,300-member military force to expel al-Qaeda from Mali. The regional force is backed by the African Union and Economic Community of West African States. Christopher Anders of the American Civil Liberties Union says any new authorization for U.S. military intervention is a mistake. He maintains that this is the, quote, kind of thing that Americans could end up regretting. We could end up in another decade-long war if this crazy idea isn't stopped. Palestinian farmer Khaled Mukarker is struggling to save what remains of his banana trees. Over the last decade, the water level in his well has dropped by 30 feet, and a nearby water spring has run dry. Even before the recent Israeli military assault on Gaza, scarce water resources in the West Bank and Gaza were stoking Israeli-Palestinian tensions with charges of water favoritism and mismanagement. Despite rising rhetoric, the Joint Water Committee, formed in 1995 as part of the Oslo peace process, is working to manage shared water resources between Israel and the Palestinian territories. The Oslo Pact gave Israel the right to 483 million cubic feet of water under the West Bank. Palestinians have rights to 118 million feet of water and the right to develop 78 million cubic feet in new water resources. Over the last 17 years, the Palestinian population has surged along with the demand for water, yet the Palestinian Authority has not been able to develop new aquifer projects. In Hamas-controlled Gaza, cut off from Western aid, 90% of the water from the main aquifer is not safe to drink because of contamination by raw sewage. For years, the shortage of water has hampered Palestinian agriculture. A 2009 World Bank study estimated the West Bank lost 100,000 jobs because it lacks water irrigation. Phoenix real estate investor Jim Shee was never stopped by police until his 70th birthday. That came in early 2010 during the debate over Arizona's harsh immigration law, SB 1070, later signed by Governor Jan Brewer. Shee, the son of a Chinese immigrant born in Tucson, was stopped for a second time days later by a state trooper near Yuma. Law enforcement wanted to check his papers. Shee was the only Asian American to join the civil rights lawsuit challenging SB 1070, known as the Papers, Please Law, which is still pending in federal court in Phoenix. In reflecting on the traffic stops, Shee told the Arizona Republic, "I've never experienced any discrimination in my life, and then bam, twice. It made me feel like I should carry around my passport all the time." Ironically, most Asian Americans in Arizona supported SB 1070 when it was signed by Governor Brewer in 2010. Many had apparently forgotten their own history. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 banned the entry of all Chinese immigrants to the United States except for children of U.S. citizens. The Pew Hispanic Center estimates that about 1 in 10 undocumented immigrants currently living in the U.S. are Asian. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
When U.S. Senator Barack Obama of Illinois was running for president in 2007 and 2008, he pledged to end indefinite detention and the rendition of terrorism suspects to other countries where they were often tortured. The former constitutional law professor also promised to close the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. As he campaigned 4 years ago, Mr. Obama vowed to govern the country differently than George W. Bush, respecting the separation of powers and not acting unilaterally to extend the power of the executive branch. But once in the Oval Office, President Obama quickly set aside his campaign rhetoric and proceeded to continue many of the Bush administration's post-9/11 war on terror policies. The Obama White House has supported an extended government warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens, decided not to prosecute Bush administration officials who ordered torture, and exponentially increased the number of drone attacks launched abroad, targeting militants, and at least two cases, killed U.S. citizens without due process. More recently, Mr. Obama signed into law the National Defense Authorization Act, which permits the government to indefinitely detain American citizens. Thus far, the Obama administration has failed to close the U.S. prison at Guantanamo. One of the nation's boldest and most consistent critics of the erosion of civil liberties that has occurred under both the Bush and Obama administrations is author and Guardian newspaper columnist Glenn Greenwald. Your reporter spoke with Greenwald, who was attending an early December conference on ending indefinite detention at Central Connecticut State University. Here he talks about his concern that in Mr. Obama's second term, civil liberties will continue to erode.
As far as the second term is concerned, one way to look at it is that if you believe that President Obama has been pursuing policies in the first 4 years that he didn't really want to pursue, that he doesn't actually believe in, that he was only pursuing because he had to for political necessity, I suppose he could be optimistic that now that the election is behind him, he'll abandon those policies and do things in a better way. But I don't believe that about him. I don't think that these policies are ones that he is opposed to secretly in his heart. I think he's been very clear and vigorous in his defense of them. There was no political compulsion for him to do these things. He chose to do them on his own. He was elected on a platform of reversing many of these policies. Clearly, he had people behind him who would have supported him if he had. He chose not to. I think that's because he wants to preserve his own power, to expand his own power. And if anything, I believe that the second term means that he no longer needs the core base of his party and can be even more unrestrained in pursuing these policies than he's been in the past. I think the opposite outcome is more likely.
Just after the election, there were reports that the Obama administration had tried to codify their kill list for the unmanned aerial drone program. And you've written your concern that this, of course, now institutionalizes this act of the president having the sole power, at least we don't know how the inner workings of the White House, but it seems that he's got personal and complete control over this assassination list, which I think is unprecedented in our history, at least in such an open way, because it's kind of common knowledge that's what's going on. What are any checks and balances on that, incredible grab for power in making these assassination lists that's quite out in the open now?
Well, there are zero checks and balances, and this is the core of the problem, is that there's nobody that can exercise any oversight in terms of who the president decides who should die, the reasons that he decides that, who it is that is putting together the list of potential candidates and what criteria are used to determine who will be targeted. Not only is there no oversight mechanism or checks and balances of any kind, there's also no due process involved. So the person who is targeted has no opportunity to contest the allegations made against them, to deny the evidence that's being used to suggest that they've done something wrong. And worse still, there's no transparency to it. So we don't even know who the president is targeting for assassination, let alone what his reasons are. So that not only is there no check on or oversight mechanism, which is the crux of the American Republic, that people who can exercise power without checks will inevitably abuse it. That was the whole premise of the founding. But there's not even any transparency for us to know how many people are being targeted, who they are, what the criteria are. It's really the most extreme power a government can exercise, which is the power to have the president execute whomever he wants. And it's done in the most tyrannical way, which is in total secrecy and without due process. And it includes not just foreign nationals, but U.S. citizens as well. And the fact that this power has been so systematically entrenched now means that there really is no conceivable end to it. If Barack Obama has the power and authority to exercise his power, then it means the next president, whether a Republican or a Democrat, will have that authority as well. And that's what makes it so dangerous to acquiesce to it.
Do you think these imperial presidential powers that Obama has now taken for himself can be challenged in the Supreme Court? And I say that recognizing there's a very conservative bent to this current Supreme Court, which may reduce the odds of anything happening there. But what are your thoughts on the most effective ways to challenge what Obama is institutionalizing as an imperial presidency?
Well, unfortunately, the Supreme Court, which is really intended to be the ultimate institution to check these abuses, and the reason I say that is because the concern that the founders had most was that these abuses would be directed toward the marginalized groups, the powerless groups, as a way of institutionalizing them. And typically, institutions that are democratically accountable, like the Congress, are afraid to side with marginalized groups by virtue of the fact that they're marginalized. The judiciary was really supposed to be the institution that would have no fear of doing that. That's why they're not elected, they're appointed, and especially why they have life tenure, to immunize them from these politically driven fears of protecting the rights of people who are marginalized. And yet the history of the Supreme Court in the wake of 9/11 is probably the most shameful and disgraceful of any of the institutions that have failed in their duties. Because almost invariably, the federal judiciary has sided with the U.S. government, especially over the rights of Muslims whenever the word terrorism is invoked. The Constitution has basically been disregarded. Even establishment sources like Andy Rosenthal, who's the editorial page editor of the New York Times, has written that we've created this separate system of justice for Muslim Americans in the United States in the wake of 9/11. And the federal judiciary really has been completely complicit in that. They've imposed a few very kind of mild restraints on some of presidential power, but by and large, they've acquiesced almost completely to executive power. So the ultimate check, the last check on abuse of power, is supposed to lie with the citizenry. And you did see a lot of pushback in the Bush era when these policies were quite controversial. You had very divisive debates over them. You had all kinds of political movements that were devoted to condemning and denouncing and fighting against assertions of executive transgressions by the Bush administration. You see much, much, much less of that now under the Obama administration because Democrats were behind most of those protests, and the vast bulk of Democrats are now willing to endorse what they were once just a few years ago condemning because it's a Democratic president doing it. So ultimately, it's the responsibility of the citizenry to push back against these kind of abuses. The problem has been that partisan allegiance has trumped any sort of commitment to principle and has made these protests really kind of marginalized.
That was former constitutional lawyer and Guardian columnist Glenn Greenwald. He's the author of four books, including With Liberty and Justice for Some. Find links to more discussion about the assault on civil liberties on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Bill McKibben, the author of a dozen books about the environment and founder of the grassroots climate change campaign group 350.org, just completed a 21-city tour focused on applying pressure on colleges and universities to divest their portfolios of fossil fuel stocks. McKibben's Do the Math tour was based on his article in Rolling Stone magazine last summer that explained that no more than 20% of the known reserves of coal, oil, and natural gas can be extracted and burned if we are to limit the warming of the Earth's atmosphere to no more than 2 degrees Celsius. That's the amount above which scientists predict life on Earth will be dramatically disrupted. Before launching the divestment campaign, McKibben discussed the idea with Desmond Tutu and other South African activists who helped organize the international anti-apartheid divestment campaign of the 1980s that helped topple South Africa's racist government. Jamie Henn is one of the co-founders of 350.org, along with a handful of other students at Vermont's Middlebury College, where McKibben is a writer in residence. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Henn, now serving as 350.org's communications director, about the goals of his group's divestment campaign and the dire challenges of climate change.
We kicked off this Do the Math tour the day after the election on November 7th in Seattle, Washington, and sold out the big Benaroya concert hall there, over 2,000 people. It was an amazing start to the tour. And after that, it just kept gaining steam and sold out 21 shows across the country, amazing crowds, and I think really helped kickstart this new effort to really take on the fossil fuel industry.
So this campaign is harking back to the divestment campaign against apartheid South Africa, which urged divestment from businesses that operated there under apartheid. How exactly will your campaign work?
As you said, we're sort of looking at the example of the movement in the 1980s that helped end apartheid as a great organizing tool. What happened during apartheid was colleges and universities and then quickly cities and states around the United States took part in pressuring institutions to divest their holdings, in the case of colleges and universities, that's their endowments, from the apartheid government in South Africa. And it had two major effects. One was really beginning to paint the apartheid issue as a moral fight, something that it was just wrong to be connected to. If you cared about liberty and human rights, you couldn't be putting your money into South Africa. Second was a real economic argument that by divesting, companies or institutions could really have a big impact on the companies that were invested in South Africa and begin to put pressure on them to take action. So we've learned a lot from that fight and learned a lot from talking with people who are involved in it, and now are spreading this similar effort on fossil fuel around the country. And it's been amazing to watch. As of today, over 160 colleges have signed up across the country. They range from big state schools like the University of Wisconsin to small liberal arts colleges. And it's incredibly exciting to really see students completely get this and understand the logic that if it's wrong to wreck the planet, then it's also wrong to profit from that wreckage, and begin to push their administrations to divest. As of today, only two schools have fully divested, but again, we're only 3 weeks into the campaign, so it's doing pretty well. That's Hampshire College in Massachusetts and Unity College up in Maine. At other campuses, discussion is at varying stages.
Jamie Henn, I know it's hard to find out where and how much colleges have invested their endowment money, but I guess it's safe to say the amount invested in fossil fuel companies must vary a lot.
There's a range, you know, on campuses of how much money they have invested in the fossil fuel industry. But it's still very doable for most schools to move away from it. And the reason why is because there's lots of great new investment vehicles that allow for people to invest in renewable energy companies and in the type of actually campus improvement projects that not only help retrofit a building on campus or install solar panels in the community, but also give a great rate of return and a better rate of return than you could get by putting your money on Wall Street. So we're excited that this movement, you know, won't just be about the moral case for divestment, as important as that is, but also trying to make the case for reinvestment and saying, hey, instead of taking these billions of dollars and giving them to the richest companies on the planet and putting it through Wall Street, why can't we reinvest back into our communities, create local jobs, and get a good rate of return on new types of investments? So it's been exciting to see that beginning to happen.
You mentioned my alma mater, the University of Wisconsin. So is there a role for alumni, a way they can get a piece of the action?
Definitely. Well, and that's what's been really fun about this campaign. It's actually connecting alumni with current students and having them strategize together about how to push the institution to take action. It's something that we're hoping to do a lot more of over the coming weeks. We're kind of just setting it up now. Alumni can do a lot. You know, you may have noticed that your school probably still maintains an interest in you and wants your donations. They also want to hear alumni opinion. And so one of the things we've been encouraging alumni to do right away is send a letter to your university, either directly to the administration or publishing, you know, a letter to the editor or even an op-ed in a campus newspaper or alumni magazine, raising the issue, maybe reflecting back on the anti-apartheid movement and thinking about how the school could move in this new direction. That's begun to happen on a lot of campuses, and it's been really exciting to see and really inspiring for the students. I think that this is an interesting moment. You know, this isn't the 1960s. I think that students still trust people over the age of 30 and, in fact, really want to work with them and connect with them and be in partnership on this. So while this in many ways is youth-led on the campuses, it's been really fun and really meaningful for students to be able to connect with alumni and professors and other advisors and put together really a kind of full-circle campaign on a college. And again, have a dialogue with the administration. We're not out to antagonize the many good people that work at universities. I think the goal is to spark a discussion and force them to make a difficult choice. I think that we begin to need to take bolder action now. The latest reports coming out of scientific agencies show that we're really running out of time, and that in order to keep global warming below this target of 2 degrees, which even the most conservative governments on the planet, including the United States, have signed on to, we need to keep upwards of around 80% of the fossil fuel reserves that these companies have in the ground. That's a big task, and it's going to take really serious government regulation. It's going to take a movement of people all across the country and around the world pushing for it. Divestment is one way to make that moral case, to get the discussion going, and to begin to build the political will necessary for the type of regulations that we need.
That was Jamie Henn, communications director with 350.org. Learn more about the group's divestment campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the latest assault on labor rights in the U.S., the state of Michigan's legislature has passed so-called right-to-work legislation, which allows workers represented by a union in the public and private sector to opt out of paying union dues. Michigan's Republican Governor Rick Snyder has vowed to sign the bill into law, maintaining the measure as pro-worker and will attract jobs to the state. The corporate-backed drive in Michigan is seen by the labor movement as part of a coordinated attack against unions that was launched last year against public employees' collective bargaining rights in the states of Wisconsin, Ohio, and Indiana. The tactics used by the Republican majority in the lame duck session of the legislature angered many. The anti-union bill was initially passed in one day, with no committee hearings or opportunity for public input. In response, more than 10,000 union members and their allies from across Michigan filled the Capitol building in Lansing and surrounding streets on December 11th to protest the right-to-work bill. While labor leaders pledged to fight the law, their options are limited due to a deliberate provision in the bill that prevents repeal by voter referendum. An effort to prevent attacks on labor failed when Michigan voters rejected Referendum Proposal 2 in November that would have enshrined union rights in the state's constitution. When signed into law, Michigan, the birthplace of the U.S. labor movement, will become the 24th state in the nation to adopt right-to-work legislation, an ironic symbol of unionism's decline across the country. Your reporter spoke with Frank Hammer, a retired United Auto Workers Union plant chairperson and frequent contributor to Labor Notes magazine. Here he assesses the latest assault on workers' rights in Michigan and the challenges ahead for the nation's labor movement.
What we see here in Michigan is the latest chapter in this sequel to Wisconsin and the sequel to other similar efforts in Indiana and Ohio, where they're trying to take down the might of the industrial unions, and they're using the lame duck legislature here in Michigan to do that, to pass these onerous right to work laws. They really demonstrated that when government wants to work quickly, by God, they can be very quick at it, and they did this all in one day. They had legislation pass the House, pass the Senate, and they're going to have it in the governor's desk all within the last period of less than a week. They've stripped all public comments out of the process. They've stripped all reference to legislative committees out of the process, and they're including an appropriations bill alongside or as part of the legislation, and apparently, according to Michigan law, an appropriations bill, it cannot go to the public and cannot be reversed in a referendum.
Maybe you could talk a little bit more about the fact that this legislation has made its way through the House, the State House and the State Senate without hearings, without any public comment or input. How unusual is that for the state legislature up there in Michigan? It doesn't sound very much the model of democracy.
You're right. It's very unusual. And it seems that with the lame duck session, coupled with the fact that Governor Snyder has all along taken the position that he didn't think that this was a priority for the state of Michigan. He thought it was going to be divisive in the state and so on. In spite of all these protests that he was, in fact, not favoring it, on a dime he switched and now has indicated that he's all for it. And he's going to sign it into law, come hell or high water, and that's what he's proceeding to do. So this is coming from a number of well-funded, right-wing, anti-government, anti-union establishments, including the Michigan Freedom Fund, Americans for Prosperity, the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, the Chamber of Commerce. They have all come together, and they're the ones that have really put the bang on Snyder and made him change his tune.
Frank, the supporters of right-to-work legislation make the case that it's going to be helpful in getting jobs to the state of Michigan, better for business, make the state more competitive. But of course, people who oppose right-to-work say that it's really a right to work for less, as the slogan goes, that marginalizing unions, as this legislation does, would actually mean a decline in the standard of living for a lot of people who depend on unions to maintain a decent, fair wage and benefits.
Yeah, I think that if you look at the actual, you know, data and actual statistics, you find that there are states with right-to-work laws that have worse unemployment rates than Michigan, for example, North Carolina. And then on the other hand, there are states that have union protections that are high employment states, and I would cite Minnesota and Vermont as examples. So the data and the facts on the ground belie the claim that this is a job creator. That argument and the argument of freedom of choice are the two arguments that are being put across in these one-minute ads on TV and radio. Both of them are fictions, and they really, what they're designed to do is mask that they're actually, this is a power grab. This is to diminish the power of the labor movement and the working class in Michigan so that we can't protect ourselves against aggressive employers, and we can't champion our political goals in the state government and so on using union clout and union organizations. So that's really the goal of the right to work, and has little to do with job creation, and it certainly has nothing to do with freedom of choice.
Frank, what are the labor union's plans right now and their allies in the state of Michigan to oppose this legislation, given what you said before, which is that there's some money attached to this bill, which makes it difficult or impossible to put it up for a referendum to voters?
And I'm sure that over the next couple months, there'll be some strategies that are going to be folding out. I think that they may go after some of the legislators that voted on behalf of this draconian legislation. And I think that maybe the unions will find ways to hurt businesses that were supporting this, maybe find ways to hurt their business and let them know that if you hurt us, you know, we're fully capable of hurting you.
That was Frank Hammer, a retired United Auto Workers Union plant chairperson and frequent contributor to Labor Notes magazine. For more information on right-to-work legislation and the labor movement's response, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.